Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present David Pomerantz of Greenpeace USA, who assesses the agreement signed by 195 nations at the recently concluded UN Climate Summit in Paris. Leticia Colon de Mejias, who talks about how she became an environmentalist and climate activist, and the importance of conservation in reducing energy consumption and carbon emissions. And Gabrielle Hetland, Assistant Professor of Latin American Studies, who analyzes the results of Venezuela's recent election, where the ruling United Socialist Party lost control of the nation's legislature. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After an initial surge, France's anti-immigrant, anti-Islamist National Front Party failed to win any of the nation's regions in the second round of elections. National Front leader Marine Le Pen led in the first round in the northern French district near Calais, that is suffering with a 15% unemployment rate and is the site of a large migrant encampment. But when the socialist candidate pulled out of the final round, the vote swung to the former Conservative Party employment minister, a tactical retreat repeated in other districts that deprived the National Front of victory. Despite coming in third place in the regional elections, the National Front has made tactical gains in the run up to the 2017 French presidential election. After the election results were reported, France's socialist Prime Minister Manuel Valls declared, "Tonight there is no relief, no triumphalism, no message of victory. The danger of the far right has not been removed, far from it." In the end, the mainstream parties split control of regional governments, with former President Nicolas Sarkozy's conservative Les Républicains party winning 7 regions and the socialists 5. Paris political scientist Thomas Guénolé opined, "Everybody lost this election, especially the French voters who only cast a vote against something. There are voters who suffocated from lack of choices and alternatives offered by the mainstream parties. They want to be able to vote for something once again." Republican insurgent Ted Cruz is using a massive database of psychological profiles on millions of Facebook users to target potential voters for his conservative presidential campaign. In recent weeks, Cruz has mobilized growing numbers of Tea Party and evangelical voters, especially in Iowa. According to the Guardian newspaper, Cruz has hired little-known British data firm Cambridge Analytica to build personality profiles of potential voters using personal data without the knowledge of most Facebook users. The firm was hired with funds from Cruz's super PAC called Keep the Promise One, largely financed by hedge fund mogul Robert Mercer. The large database of Facebook likes is matched with other voter databases to identify traits such as who may own a gun. Documents obtained by The Guardian show Cambridge Analytica's London-based parent company, Strategic Communications Laboratories, was first introduced to the concept of using social media data to model human personality traits in early 2014 by Dr. Alexandra Kogan, a lecturer at Cambridge University's renowned psychology department. Kogan compiled a massive database of over 40 million people in the U.S. with detailed personality profiles. Over the last few years, conservative political campaigns, including GOP presidential candidate Ben Carson, have hired Cambridge Analytica to employ its millions of profiles to design targeted political messages on multiple platforms. Texas evangelical preacher Bob Roberts fits the profile of a conservative minister looking to spread the gospel far and wide. His spiritual journey has taken him to unusual places like Doha, Qatar, to build interfaith understanding between Christians and Muslims. Over the last 30 years, Roberts has emerged as a leading opponent of Islamophobia. Roberts, who leads a 3,000-member evangelical church outside of Dallas, has been honored by the White House for his interfaith work. The pastor told the Christian Science Monitor, "Right now, the biggest challenge is in my tribe, the evangelicals. The battle for religious tolerance has only gotten tougher in the wake of the mass shooting in San Bernardino and the call by Republican frontrunner Donald Trump to ban all Muslim immigration into the United States. So it's surprising that there are a growing number of evangelical mosque partnerships emerging. In July, 3 Muslim charities raised $100,000 in a crowdfunding campaign to help rebuild 8 black evangelical congregations in the American South that were targets of suspected arson. After a shooting incident at a military recruiting station in Chattanooga, Tennessee in July, Franklin Graham, the son of famed evangelist Billy Graham, complained on Facebook, "We are under attack from Muslims at home and abroad. We should stop immigration of all Muslims to the U.S. until this threat from Islam has been settled." Along with Muslim advocacy groups, Roberts condemned Graham's hateful post on Facebook during a press conference, stating, "Standing up for the rights of Muslims to worship impacts the rights of Christians to worship around the world." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
While U.S. President Barack Obama and other world leaders hailed the agreement hammered out between 195 countries at the United Nations Paris Climate Summit as a success and a turning point, many climate activists, while acknowledging areas of progress, took a more critical view. Pledges from 186 of the 195 nations participating in the summit to reduce the growth of their greenhouse gas emissions to limit a rise in global temperatures to 2 degrees Celsius but pursue a limit of 1.5 degrees is commendable. But according to various research groups, even if every nation honored their announced carbon emission reduction targets, the world would still be headed toward a 3.5 degrees Celsius rise in temperature by the end of the century. That increase, scientists predict, can lead to crop failures, food shortages, and widespread plant and animal life extinctions. The Paris Climate Agreement is not legally binding, in large part because the Republican Party, which controls the U.S. Congress, would never have approved this global treaty. But other provisions in the deal call for mandatory 5-year review of greenhouse gas reduction pledges from each country, with transparency in the efforts made to reach national carbon emission goals. Your reporter spoke with David Pomerantz, a senior climate and energy campaigner with Greenpeace USA, who assesses the strengths and weaknesses of the climate agreement and the hard work ahead for climate activists across the globe.
It's pretty significant that the vast majority of humanity effectively has come together and said some very basic things, and some things that hadn't been said before. So, you know, one of the good things is that the Paris Agreement sets out the objective of limiting global temperature rises to 1.5 degrees Celsius. That's an extremely ambitious target. It's a target that would have been much easier to reach if we'd made this kind of agreement 20 years ago. Unfortunately, the political leaders of the world have wasted a lot of time. But it is important that has finally been put on paper. It's been agreed to by all the large emitters of the world, including the U.S. and China and India and many others. And so that's really significant. The bad, I think, is that the plans, the intended plans that every country has submitted, including the U.S., it's widely recognized they're not going to cut it to get down to that 1.5 degree temperature rise limit that the agreement strives for. The best science we have would indicate that the plans that the countries have put forward would leave us more in the 3 to 3.5 degree Celsius range. So that's really significant. It would be catastrophic. And now Paris is from this point on, the starting point where we have to have a massive increase in ambition. So I would say this agreement certainly won't dig us out of the hole we've dug for ourselves as a planet, but it does make the sides a bit less steep.
David, as I understand it, in advance of the summit, many of the poor nations around the world reiterated their need in order to cope with adaptation to climate change that is already going on and to also move to renewable energy sources in the future to mitigate their production of greenhouse gases that contribute to climate change, that they wanted a guarantee of some funding to do what they are unable to do themselves. What came out of the Paris conference for these developing nations that want to do something but don't have the economic means?
Yeah, like much of the agreement, that's another case where you have a good and bad side. So the finance text in the agreement was watered down pretty dramatically to get a deal. And unfortunately, the U.S. was a big part of why that happened. there is still some progress compared to where we were before Paris. Developed countries' existing commitment to mobilize $100 billion, that's U.S. dollars a year, for emissions reductions and adaptation in developing countries, that had been in place to 2020. It got extended out to 2025. So that's a good sign. Unfortunately, we're not seeing that level of funding now already. So countries have to step up to the plate, even for what they've already committed to, and then absolutely need to see those numbers grow going forward. And there were some more ambitious financing elements that were removed from the text. So it's definitely an area where we need a lot more progress.
With the Paris Climate Summit concluded and many environmental and activist groups looking at it, believe there's some positive developments there, but it doesn't go far enough, fast enough. What is the role, in your mind, of civil society and grassroots activists organizations now to push the global community towards 100% renewable energy in order to avoid the scientifically predicted cataclysm of unmitigated climate change into the future?
Yeah, now is the time to move faster than ever. So far, the wheel of action on climate change has turned pretty slowly. But it did just sort of inch another little bit of the turn in Paris. And now, with more and more people joining this very vibrant, diverse, and growing climate movement every day, we have to make it turn faster and faster. You know, Paris, I think, was always important, but it was always just a stop in an ongoing journey. And we need to push harder and speed up. And I think people who consider themselves activists here in the U.S., or even if you don't consider yourself an activist, but you just, you know, you get it and you want to do something about it, there's no better time than now. We have a presidential election coming up next year that is going to present some pretty radically different visions of what our energy future looks like. There are a million ways to push for 100% renewable energy just locally where you live. You know, to your listeners out there, if you haven't been a part of it yet, now's the time, because we need you more than ever. And, you know, we're making progress, but we have a big job in front of us.
That was David Pomerantz, a senior climate and energy campaigner with Greenpeace USA. Find more views and analysis of the Paris Climate Summit Agreement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On December 9th, the Connecticut chapter of the League of Conservation Voters held its 15th annual environmental summit in Hartford. There, legislators gathered with environmental activists, many who are working on climate change, as the UN Climate Summit was underway in Paris. One of the keynote speakers was Rob Klee, Commissioner of the State Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, who said Connecticut, under the state's Democratic Governor Daniel Malloy, is pursuing an all-of-the-above energy policy with an emphasis on increasing the use of natural gas. The event's other keynote speaker was Leticia Colon de Mejias, a Puerto Rican mother and educator who quit her day job when she learned about the planetary threat of climate change. She became a climate activist, writing environmental books for children, and founded a company which employs 27 low-income people that retrofit homes and businesses for energy efficiency. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Mejias, who explained how, in an effort to encourage civic responsibility in her children, she learned about the climate crisis that changed her life. She also discusses alternatives to the use of natural gas and expensive pipelines as a bridge to a renewable energy future.
We started this thing of watching documentaries with our kids one day a week, and one of the first documentaries we saw was Kilowatt Hours by Jeffrey Berry, which is about climate change and mountaintop removal. And that really made me feel very passionate that I didn't know that information before. I was upset and angry that no one had told me that when I leave my lights on or, you know, my phone plugged in, that I was wasting energy and that I was impacting the environment in a negative way. Knowing that information made me feel I needed to immediately share it with others. And so my kids and I, as a project, along with my husband, started developing ways to communicate that message locally. And that's really how we got started.
Do you think that Connecticut's philosophy and practice of all of the above energy consumption is the way to go, or do you think there's a better way?
The energy crisis is real and it's a very broad problem. I think that the issue and concern I have with our state's current approach is that we are pushing gas as a renewable energy or a clean fuel, and that is actually false information. It's not that I'm against the use of natural gas. We do need to have energy, and I don't want brownouts and blackouts. It's that there are ways to offset the use of that gas, and we're spending billions of dollars on a pipeline. If we invested billions of dollars in efficiency and behavioral changes, we could possibly change this in such a way, and we haven't attempted it yet, where we don't need to build this billion-dollar pipeline, $8 billion pipeline, and we could create jobs locally immediately, increasing our income and revenue right in our own state.
You've been doing a lot of work in the micro level where you've gotten families to, you know, use cleaner energy, use less energy. And even Rob Klee, who's the, you know, commissioner of the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, one of the questions raised to him was about conservation. And he said, oh, well, you know that we're really all about that. But, you know, he didn't emphasize it until it was asked as a question. And that's something I've raised a long time, too, is like conservation is the energy you don't use and you don't pay for. So What are your thoughts about what you've already done that's impacted this positively, or what you think could be done on a broader scale?
I think it's extremely important for us to talk about real facts and to look at the behavioral opportunities that there are. When we talk about our campaign of switch it off, which means to turn off your electronics when you're not using them, which would seem quite simple, but it actually isn't happening in many places. We talk about an immediate savings of 10 to 15%. That is a huge savings. And if you couple that with renewable resources, true renewable resources like solar, geothermal, hydroelectric, then you really are looking at, you know, maybe offsetting 50% of our energy use. And I think that's a real approach to an immediate reduction of fossil fuel and carbon emissions.
And one thing he said was that, you know, you need the solar and wind, for example, are intermittent. And so you need a base load like gas or like oil or coal. But now if you want to get away from oil and coal, the gas is supposed to be cleaner. How do you respond to that, that we can't just go with renewables and conservation, that we have to have this underlying support of a steady form of energy?
I think that anytime people in a position of power deny the scientific facts that are right in front of all of us and easily obtainable, like gas is not necessarily more clean than coal or oil, for example, and that it has other serious issues that have not yet been really explored in depth, like the process of fracking, the extraction of the gas, the implications on our water tables that brings, which are extremely important to all people, again, that you're really not looking at the problem as a whole. And what can we do to reduce our energy usage? Like immediately looking at our state buildings and saying, why do they have incandescents? Talking about turning our heat down to 68 degrees. Or talking about deeply insulating and retrofitting our buildings and homes. Let's try that. Let's see what happens. And sure, if we need to have a buffer of some fossil fuel after we've done those insanely simple and low-cost measures, then yeah, we should talk about that next. But first, we need to take real actionable steps to reduce our energy consumption residentially, commercially, and in our state buildings.
Leticia Colon de Mejias, you work with mostly low-income minority populations, which tend to be underrepresented in the climate movement in the U.S., at least. What have you found to be effective in doing this work?
I think if people from diverse minority populations are given the information, which they've not been provided correctly, in school and in communities, that it's everyone's problem, it's affecting them, it's affecting their health, it's affecting our climate, it's going to overall affect everything around us, then they would get involved, absolutely. But they don't know, and you don't know what you don't know. So the first step is educating that population on how it relates to them and what they can do to join the fight to save our planet.
That was Connecticut climate activist Leticia Colon de Mejias. Learn more about her projects, including Green Eco Warriors, which focuses on environmental education for young people, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As Venezuelans went to cast their ballots in the nation's December 6th parliamentary election, the primary issue on the minds of most voters was the failing economy skyrocketing inflation, and severe shortages of basic goods on store shelves across the country. When ballots were counted, the ruling United Socialist Party of Venezuela, founded by the late populist leader Hugo Chavez, suffered a humiliating defeat. The opposition Democratic Unity Front won 56% of the vote, while the socialists won just 41%. Under Venezuela's electoral system, the opposition now holds a two-thirds majority of seats in parliament and the power to challenge incumbent socialist president Nicolas Maduro's programs, appointments, and budget. Although U.S. politicians and corporate media have long attacked Venezuela's socialist government, in power for 17 years, as a dictatorship, President Maduro, Chavez's hand-picked successor, immediately recognized the opposition's landslide victory. But in a televised address, he reminded the nation of the long history of U.S.-supported coups in Latin America, including Washington's support for the attempted overthrow of Chavez in 2002, and blamed what he called the conservative counter-revolution for sabotaging the oil-dependent economy and destabilizing his rule. Your reporter spoke with Gabriel Hetland, assistant professor of Latin American, Caribbean, and U.S. Latino studies at the University at Albany, State University of New York, who analyzes the results of the Venezuelan election and the fate of Hugo Chavez's political legacy that he called socialism for the 21st century.
Hugo Chavez and his party won 16 out of 17 electoral contests when he was in office, and then of the 20 that have happened since he was elected in 1998, they won 18 of those. What happened in this election was that the opposition turned out very strongly, but just there was a slight increase in the opposition vote, about 4 to 5% compared to what it was in the 2013 presidential election in April. And there was a massive abstention on the part of Chavista voters, almost 2 million who stayed home compared to the turnout for the Chavista vote in that same election in April 2013. So the really big difference in turnout certainly explains the result, although there was about 400,000 voters roughly who switched sides. So clearly there is some defection of Chavista voters to the opposition. I think the economic crisis that Venezuela has been facing over the last year and a half is really at the heart of the reason why some of the voters are switching and why many Chavistas were basically protesting against the government by not showing up to vote at all.
Now, a lot of voters, of course, blame the incumbent president, Nicolas Maduro, for the economic problems. But many Chavistas, people loyal to the United Socialist Party, have long thought that opposition parties aligned with the United States and other external actors were in some way responsible for at least part of Venezuela's economic problems. When you examine what economic issues are going on in Venezuela, inflation and the shortage of goods, where do you trace the problem to?
There's three things I think that are behind the current economic crisis. One of them is a fall in the price of oil, which has happened since about June 2014, when it was, I think, around $107, $108 a barrel. And about a week ago, at least, it was $37 a barrel. So there's been a massive fall in the price of oil, and Venezuela's budget is very dependent on oil. I think about 96% of their export earnings come from oil, and then 40 to 45% of the federal budget comes from oil. So when the price of oil drops, it's just a huge hit that the government and all the social programs and things that they've been spending money on for over a decade, they all take a hit as well. The second really important thing, and this is where the government has prime responsibility or certainly a large degree of responsibility, is a huge gap between the official exchange rate for the bolivar, the Venezuelan currency, which is 6.3 to the dollar, and then the black market exchange rate has gotten up to over 800 to 1 to the dollar. So over 125 times, almost 150 times difference between the black market rate and the regular rate. The government's been afraid for various reasons to try to reduce that gap, which they would be able to do through a devaluation of the currency. The reason the government hasn't done that is at least partly because it would raise prices for certain goods, or at least that's the fear, that there'd be additional inflation. Some people think there's been so much inflation already that that's not a big fear, but there's questions about that. The third thing, and this is what the government's been saying, is that there's an economic war being waged against the government, against the sort of people of Venezuela by opposition sort of sympathetic business sectors that are
hoping that the government will suffer, which they did in this election, if they can generate economic chaos within the country. It's somewhat difficult to find smoking gun evidence for this view. And to give you a sense of how Venezuelan people feel about it, there's been some recent polls maybe a few weeks ago showing that 70% of people in Venezuela didn't think that that was the main or even a primary cause of the economic crisis. And then the other 30% said, well, even if there's an economic war, the government's losing. So whether or not that's the key factor, people haven't been satisfied with the government's response to it.
Well, Gabriel, just a final question here is, with the United Socialist Party of Hugo Chavez and his successor at the helm, Nicolas Maduro, losing big time to the opposition in Venezuela, a lot of people have questions about the future of Chavez and his socialist revolution, which is credited with reducing poverty and advancing equality in Venezuela. What is your outlook for Chavez and his revolution after this defeat?
Yeah, I mean, I think they really have to acknowledge some responsibility for the economic mess the country's in. I don't think that the vote that happened on Sunday, December 6th, so about two Sundays ago, can in any way be seen as a mandate for free market capitalism. It's really about correcting the economy. I think if the government can make progress towards correcting the economy, they can certainly stay in power. I think there's millions and millions in Venezuela who want a return to the policies that were helping to reduce poverty and inequality and unemployment and raising healthcare standards and giving people pensions when they didn't have it before. They really want to return to those policies. So doing that will require better policies to fix the economic mess the country's in. I don't think the opposition has great plans in order to do that. And so if the government can make some progress on that, I think that they can stay in power and continue to do some of the things they've been doing before. If they don't make progress on that, I think it's anyone's bet in terms of what might happen. There will probably be a recall referendum against Nicolas Maduro in particular if the economy stays bad. And if the economy is not being fixed at that point, it may be the case that more Chavistas vote against the government or that they just stay home. And that could certainly create the conditions for the opposition to win a recall and then set up a new contest for the presidency.
That was Gabriel Hetland, assistant professor of Latin American, Caribbean, and U.S. Latino studies at the University at Albany, New York. Find links to his recent Nation magazine article titled "Why Venezuela's Ruling Party Lost Big" and related analysis of the election by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.